for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Simon Tolkien is the grandson of the legendary author of The Lord of the Rings. He's just published his own second novel, and it's written in an entirely different style from that of his grandfather's fantasies. The title is The Inheritance, and it mixes old-school murder mystery with courtroom melodrama. Simon Tolkien joins me in the studio. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, Simon. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Diane. It's
my
great.
Pleasure. I understand you were, 9 years old when you first read Lord of the Rings?
Eight or nine.
Tell us about your understanding of that book when you first read it.
I think you understand more each time you read it. I've read it to both my children when they've been 8 or 9. And I think the advantage of when you read it really young, like all books, is it goes straight through into your imagination. But then there's, you know, some quite complex issues that become difficult. And there are parts of The Lord of the Rings which I think are a little slower for children as well.
But did your grandfather read it to you, or did you read it yourself the first time?
I read it to myself.
That's what I thought.
You didn't read it to me.
Yeah. And so that experience that you had would have been different from that of your own children to whom you read it.
That's right. But what is also different is that I was able to actually cross-examine the author, which I think was a little bit difficult for him, because there are whole parts of The Lord of the Rings, and I think why it's so successful is that there are areas that he hinted at as having already been written, but which hadn't been written, which gives it this underlying feeling of reality. And I wanted to hear about all these other stories that the text makes it seem as if had been written, but hadn't been written. And so he had to tell me all these stories, even though he hadn't read them. So there were wizards in the East, which were just like part of the background, but I wanted to know exactly what they had done. So I think it was quite hard on the old man to keep up.
How describe your relationship with him?
I think it had quite a lot to do with my age within my family. My parents were divorced when I was 5, and so I was an only child. My father went on to have other children, but they would be much, much younger. And so I was at just the right age to be the kind of the grandchild that you can have to stay and be a lot of fun before kids become teenagers and become difficult. I was like 10 or 11.
And you were living with your mother during this period?
Yes. I lived with my mother in a little village outside Oxford. And so I think those were different days then, Diane, back in the 60s. Kids of 10, 11 went on long train journeys all on their own.
Of course.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And so I went down to Bournemouth, where my grandfather was living, on the train, and they would meet me off the train, and I would stay with him, you know, 2-3 times a year for about a week, 10 days at a time. They lived most of the time in a hotel called the Miramar Hotel on the Bournemouth seafront. I think my grandfather found it very difficult, and he missed Oxford a great deal, but my grandmother had had quite a tough time in Oxford being a professor's wife. I don't think it's the best place to be a lady, was in Oxford back in those days, very much a male-dominated society.
I gather after she died, he moved back to Oxford.
So remember that vividly. He was back in Oxford for a year, just over a year, and his old college gave him rooms. And I would go and see him, and we'd go and have lunch in the Eastgate Hotel next door. And I think he was quite sad. I think it was very strange, having been married for more than 50 years to his wife, that he was suddenly all alone. And he certainly gave me that impression at the time. And I think, he was sad too that his great book, as he saw it, had never been published.
His great book.
Yes. I think this is something that people don't perhaps know so much about my grandfather, which is that he started writing in the trenches back in 1916, not The Lord of the Rings, a book called The Silmarillion. And he wrote it in many different ways, over and over again. And after The Hobbit was published in the 30s, his publisher asked for more Hobbits. And he came along and gave them what he'd been writing, really, for the last 25 years. And they had a look at it and said, no more Hobbits.
Ah.
So that is what gave birth to The Lord of the Rings, what he really wanted to give them, with the story of what's called the First Age, you know, the story of the gods and all there. And so then The Lord of the Rings took him completely over, and all that he'd written before never saw the light of day. So I think in his last years, he was sad in a way.
Simon Tolkien, he is or was a barrister in London, specializing in criminal justice. His brand new novel is titled The Inheritance. His previous novel, Final Witness. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. When did you, in your little boy consciousness, realize your grandfather was somebody really special?
We didn't have the movies then, Diane, so it was a book thing.
A book.
I think that I was always aware that it was a very important book. I remember a fireworks display at my school, the Dragon School in Oxford, when he came, and he was seen as a sort of something looked at by all the kids in awe. I remember that, and there's a picture of me standing next to him looking very proud of myself. It wasn't the overwhelming phenomenon that the movies introduced 10 years ago. And I was aware of him as a writer, but I think more than that as a person. I think he was a very important person in my life. I think he was quite lucky. He died when I was 14, and because what I was describing is my position in the family, we had quite a strong one-to-one relationship, and he lived long enough for me to really get quite an experience of him. And I think what made him different and unusual in a certain way was that he was really quite interested in what I felt, and I'd been through quite an emotional time, you know, with my parents' divorce and my whole reaction to that. And I think he wanted to talk to me about that, which is perhaps unusual for a grandfather. He was, after all, born in 1892, so it was from a different world.
How did he talk with you about the divorce, the separation within your family?
He wanted to know how I felt, and I think he wanted to know that my grandfather, my grandmother loved me, and that, you know, there was a place for me there as well, and I felt I really enjoyed going there. Hotels, when you're a kid, are a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, there's endless corridors and doors you shouldn't go through. And I got together with the son of the hotel owner, and we, you know, had a wonderful time penetrating into places that perhaps we shouldn't have gone into.
And what about your relationship to your mother?
My mother had to work really hard. She was a teacher. And so I think it was good holidays when I got to go off. But we lived in a very small village outside of Oxford, and it was a strange time, you know, in the 60s. I mean, everyone thinks back on the 60s as really glamorous, but where I grew up, there's no internet. There's three TV channels. They all end at 11 o'clock in the evening. And what you're left with, really, I was on my own, is this isn't a complaint at all, because I think it done me really proud in the long term, is books. And I read enormous numbers of books. And I think that that's really been a good fuel, if you like, since I've become a writer, particularly all those 19th century books, you know, the Brontes, Jane Eyre, those kind of things, a slightly sort of gothic feel. There are manor houses in my books where bad things happen, if you see what I mean.
So I think
all that was fuel, like The Lord of the Rings.
You know, it's interesting, though, to consider the perhaps psychological triumph that these two books of yours are because they're your own. They're not anything like what your grandfather has written. They come from you. Did you think of them in that way?
Yes. I think that for whatever reason, right or wrong, the coming of the Peter Jackson movies had a vast effect on me. At the time, it felt like a mountain slide was coming down towards me. And even though I was a barrister and doing fairly well at it, for some reason, it wasn't enough. I wanted to be somebody in my own right. And I felt as if I was going to be dwarfed by my grandfather. I think I'd always slightly felt that, Diane, and I think that's why I'd had this peculiar sensation that I couldn't write. I always thought I couldn't write. So I'm an unusual writer in the sense that I only started when I was 40. Never wrote a short story or anything. I wrote a diary, but nothing else. And I think that now, in retrospect, must come back to thinking that how on earth can we do anything when this man who could speak all these languages and who could do all these things and had all this knowledge was there? How can we really, or I, be legitimate in my own right? And I think that was very difficult. And then the fusion of that with the movies made me feel that I wanted to strike out on my own. And I've been lucky to be able to do so.
So being a barrister, a successful one, was not enough.
At the time, no. But I think there's other factors, and I have the benefit of hindsight. I think that being a barrister, it sounds awful to complain about it because it was absolutely fantastic, was also stressful.
Simon Tolkien, his new novel, a mystery, a courtroom melodrama, is titled The Inheritance. And here's our first email for Simon Tolkien. He is, of course, the grandson of the legendary author of The Lord of the Rings. But Simon Tolkien has struck out on his own. He is a successful barrister in London. However, he absolutely had to become a writer in his own manner, and he has done so with his new novel, The Inheritance, his previous novel, Final Witness. But here's a question about The Fellowship of the Ring from Mark in Birmingham, Alabama. He says, please ask about the character in Fellowship of the Ring, Tom Bombadil. I've heard rumors that this character was based on his son's or grandson's favorite toy. Is this true?
I have absolutely no knowledge of that, unfortunately, but I think Tom Bombadil was very dear to my grandfather's heart, and it was a vision of what life could be like in a perfect way. And I think Tom Bombadil's an exceedingly interesting character because when he's given the ring and he puts it on, the ring has absolutely no effect upon him. And when later at the Council of Elrond, they ask, why couldn't we leave the ring with Tom Bombadil and therefore it would be safe? And I can't remember, I think it's Gandalf, says, well, he would lose it. And I think this being above the cares of the world and being, as Tom says he is, eternal, is a vision of paradise. And when I was just reading the book recently to my daughter, I thought I was really moved by it, because I think that that was as far as my grandfather could imagine paradise. I think it was by the Withywindle in the Old Forest.
I really want to hear you read from your own book. I think it's important for me, it's important for you, and it's important for our audience to realize that while you have this extraordinary knowledge of what your grandfather has written, what's dear to your heart as well is what you have written. So set this up for us.
Well, when I started my book, I wanted to start it, as the publishers always want you to do, with a rush, so that people would be taken straight into it. And where I started the book was not actually in the present, but back with events that had occurred, a terrible event that occurred in northern France 15 years before, which, as the book goes on, has a greater and greater effect on what is happening in the present day.
So the year is
Normandy, 1944. Shall I read, Diane?
Please.
They were safe in the trees, waiting for the Germans to come. Carson had driven the jeep off the drive, and the silver-grey branches had crackled and broke as he'd wedged it into his hiding place. And now they waited on either side of the road with the fingers on the triggers of their American-made machine guns. Nothing. No wind in the trees, no movement in the air, until just after 8 o'clock, when the dust came up in a yellow cloud and the two trucks came round the corner. And then Ritter felt the bullets feeding through the magazine, the quick vibrations in his arms from the gun, and saw the men in the trucks jumping up and down like puppets. There was one young soldier at the end who ran away down the road, but Colonel Cade walked out of the trees with his rifle and shot him in the back of the head just before he reached the corner. It was a good ambush. Afterward, Carson and Ritter pushed the trucks into the woods while the colonel selected rifles and pistols from the bodies of their dead owners, three of each. He made them leave their own guns behind. And so they walked on up to the house, with the dead soldiers' rifles slung over their shoulders and the snub-nosed German Mauser pistols in their pockets. They were a strange, ill-assorted group. Walking in the middle, the tall, thin colonel towered over his two companions. His pale blue eyes were almost opaque, revealing nothing of the man inside, and his long, aquiline nose gave him an ascetic look that seemed oddly at variance with his uniform. And yet he carried himself with an air of natural authority that made it obvious that he was the man in charge. Continue?
Continue.
On the colonel's right, Sergeant Ritter was far more clearly a military man, with his clipped black moustache and polished shoes and buttons. He was a big man, and he had begun to sweat in the evening heat. But he didn't complain. He knew that they had work to do. Looking past the colonel, Ritter glared over at Corporal Carson, who was walking with a deliberate swagger, swaying his narrow hips and shoulders as he expertly flicked a piece of chewing gum from one side of his mouth to the other in time with each step he took. The young man's disrespect disgusted Ritter, but he kept his peace. Carson had been the only soldier he could find to do the job. He'd have to do. They walked past green, stony fields and rows of overgrown vines until they came to a fork in the drive and past an old sign on which someone had once upon a time painted the words Propriété Privée. It was nailed to the trunk of a plane tree, and Carson read it out loud in his Cockney accent and laughed like it was some kind of joke. But the colonel ignored him. He had other things on his mind.
Tell me what's happening.
There are three men who are walking up towards a house, and in the house there is a family. And the colonel believes, has strong reason to believe, that the family are hiding a book. And he believes that the book will lead him, if he gains it, via a code, to a cross. And the cross is what's on the front of the book, an ancient, wonderful, life-changing historical cross. And he's prepared to do almost anything, and in fact does everything, to this family, murders them, in order to gain control of this book.
And then, as the book begins, you leap ahead to the present day.
That's right, Diane, to the colonel's son, who is standing trial in London, accused of the colonel's murder with overwhelming evidence against him. And as that trial goes on and he's convicted of the murder and then faces the death sentence, this being 1960, the policeman has to look into these past events and in fact eventually go to France to find out the secret of what may really have happened.
And of course at the time, once an individual is sentenced to death, he must be executed within, what, 3.5 weeks?
It was very quick. I still find this very surprising, having been, you know, in my adult life more familiar with death row in the United States, that how quickly the appeal was processed and the sentence carried out. It was very, very quick. And I have a note about that. Within a month, the people were usually put to death.
And that was in order to rid society of those it believed to have committed heinous crimes, or because they did not want to spend the money on long appeals. What was the reason for the haste?
I felt that I think that the reality would not have been money at that point. There may have been a sense, I don't think there was a sense of humanity involved. However, I think that the authorities would have felt that a trial was sufficient and the appeal process was quick and there would be nothing else that was necessary to go through, because the number of courts that one would go through in the US now is very different to there. You would have a trial in the High Court, the Old Bailey, and then you would go straight to the Court of Appeal. Then there would be a decision by the Home Secretary whether to grant a mercy. And if not, it would go straight through. So there isn't this series of courts to go through. And indeed, in my book, it's very strange because in this latter part, because we're just coming up in where I'm writing to when the death penalty was abolished in England, that they had this strange building that had been built in Wandsworth Prison. And this is based on reality, which was like a purpose-built death house. And unknown to the person who was going to die, the place that he was sitting next to in his wardrobe would swing round straight onto the gallows. And the idea being that once the hangman came through the door, they would seize the person who was going to die, swing round the wardrobe, and have them off within 30 seconds from the entrance into the room. It was very, very fast. And it's very strange and peculiar, and I use this in my book, the thought that the man who was going to die had absolutely no idea that he was sleeping within feet of the gallows.
Have you ever seen one of those rooms?
No, you can't see that in England.
You can't.
Whether it still exists,
yes.
I don't know, but you wouldn't be able to. Clearly, when I was, you know, working as a barrister, I would go and see many people in prisons, and so I've seen a lot of the inside of prisons, but not gallows chambers.
Did you handle any death penalty? But by the time you became a barrister, had the death penalty been abolished?
It's curious. The death penalty was actually finally abolished in England in 1966. We had a very peculiar hiatus period during really the time that I'm writing, where they'd abolished it for a great many offences, but they'd kept it for things like shooting. So if you shot somebody with a gun, you would be condemned to death.
What if you killed them with a knife?
No. Or
why?
if you strangled them, it
why?
Would be different, even though that was with premeditation. Well, I think in a certain sense, the legislation discredited itself, and that hastened on the actual final abolition. And there were extraordinary cases that occurred just around that time. There was a very famous case, which was known as the Let 'em Have It case, in which two men went out on a burglary. And one of them, the younger man, under the age of 21, was armed, and the other man, Derek Bentley, wasn't. And just at the moment when the policeman hailed them to come down, Bentley said to the younger man, Craig, let him have it. Now, it was ambiguous, obviously, as whether he was saying, let him have it, hand over the gun, or whether he was saying, shoot the policeman. And he was put on trial, and the jury clearly found that he had meant, let him have it, kill him. And Bentley died, and Craig, the man who had actually shot the bullet, went to prison because he was underage and came out afterwards. And then recently we've had all this revisited a great deal with a movie and such like. So there were these kind of notorious cases that really highlighted the problem there.
Did you enjoy your time as a barrister?
I loved it. It was absolutely wonderful, but it was exceedingly stressful. I don't know how trial attorneys find it in the US, but in the weekend leading up to it, it would be incredibly stressful and worrying. And I would get like a feeling of iron right across my shoulders and up into my neck. And then once the trial began and I started cross-examining witnesses and presenting the case, then all the adrenaline flowed out and everything was wonderful until the end of the case, and then it would start all over again. And I kind of felt after I'd done, you know, I'd done over 100 trials, that I wanted to do something else, you know. But it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. It's a strange being a barrister, particularly a defence barrister, because you're all on your own. The jury's there. You don't know what they're thinking. The judges are generally pretty horrid and pretty intimidating. And you've got the police and the prosecution, and they're all organising everything. So it's quite stressful.
Own.
Yeah, and often your client doesn't understand, because it's legal, quite what you're doing. And you yet have to make sure that he, you know, puts on a good show for himself. So it's a strange experience.
Simon Tolkien, his new novel, his second, is titled The Inheritance. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask another question about your grandfather. He was a devout Roman Catholic. What kind of influence did that have on you?
I think enormous, in practical ways as well. I remember very vividly going to church in Bournemouth. I suppose this would have been, again, the late 60s. And it was after the Vatican II changes in the Roman Catholic Church, which meant that people were giving the responses to the priest in English rather than Latin. And my grandfather would stand up and he would respond in Latin in a very, very loud voice. Dominus vobiscum et cum spiritu tuo. And this was absolutely awful for me because, you know, it's embarrassing. So I was just, curled up in the pew so that nobody could see me. But I think it's a hint as to how he just didn't care. He was who he was, and that was how it was.
And then there was an extraordinary and prolonged dispute over his estate.
I don't understand. Sorry, Don.
Your father and your grandfather's estate. Was there a dispute?
No, none at all. There was a subsequent problem that I had back when the movies were coming. We had a bit of a falling out with my father that's now composed. But the actual inheritance from my grandfather, who died in 1973, onto my father as literary executor, I think was entirely smooth. And what my father has done since 1973 is to edit, as I was describing, all that work that my grandfather had left behind, which had never been published, which I think hurt him so sorely. What my father's been able to do over a period of, I suppose, 25 years' work is, or more, is to put all that out into the public domain through a series of books.
Are you close to your father?
We had, as I say, a falling out, which was very sad. And then now, what's wonderful, he's quite an old man now. He's in his mid-80s, but it's all composed and we're, you know, but back on the same wavelength,
I'm
and that's
glad.
Lovely.
I'm glad. Here's a question from Jeremy, who says, it would seem there is hardly much more of an authority than Mr. Tolkien on the subject. Do you believe the Silmarillion, completed by Christopher Tolkien, relayed the original intent and story intended by your grandfather.
As I understand it, the Silmarillion was... I don't think I'm an expert on the subject of the Silmarillion, just to say as a qualification, but the Silmarillion was a series of stories that were written both in prose and in poetry over different periods between 1916 and the 1960s. And it was many of them unfinished, many of them with the characters changing. And I think it was an extremely difficult task to put together all those texts in such a way as to create a sequential story. But I think my father did his best.
Simon Tolkien, his new book is titled The Inheritance. Short break. When we come back, your questions, your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
In 1937, frustrated by a conservative Supreme Court which struck down a series of his New Deal programs, President Franklin Roosevelt tried to reform the court by expanding it and adding liberal justices. This controversial proposal failed. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jeff Schessel, author of Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court. Join us.
And welcome back to our conversation with Simon Tolkien. He was a barrister in London specializing in criminal justice and has now written a courtroom melodrama as well as a murder mystery. It's titled The Inheritance. We're going to open the phones 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Stephen. You're on the air.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to listen to this show. C.S. Lewis dedicated his book, The Screwtape Letters, to J.R.R. Tolkien. I'd love it if Simon could comment on the relationship between Lewis and Tolkien. I understand that Tolkien had some role in C.S. Lewis's conversion to Christianity, and that while Lewis was kind of a happy pagan and subsequently a happy Christian, Tolkien perhaps labored both in the literary sense and possibly spiritual sense.
Yes, it's an awfully good question. I think that they were at one point deeply close, and indeed it is my understanding that my grandfather had a major role to play in Lewis's conversion to Christianity. There is a beautiful garden at the back of Magdalen College, where Lewis was a fellow for many years before he moved to Cambridge. And the story is that they went with my grandfather for a long walk around there, in which Lewis described that he thought of religion and of belief in God as lies breathed in silver, which is a wonderful phrase, I think, and that my grandfather described to him why he believed, and that had an intense effect on Lewis. They then subsequently went in very different directions, and I think that my grandfather felt that the allegorical Christian side of the Narnia books was not what he thought was right. He believed that a story had to be in itself and for itself and readable of itself and exist in its own right, and that its value was in a certain sense, in a religious sense, as a sub-creation, that that the religious inspiration was actually the writing and the creativity, and that the story had to be itself. And I think that leads on to the big problem, in a certain sense, of reconciling what is a pantheistic universe in The Lord of the Rings with his own Catholic religion.
So he felt very strongly that his vision was the correct vision. Is that what you're saying?
I think anybody who believes, as I understand it, and I'm not a believer anymore, but anybody who believes that intensely in a religion and in a form of religion, as my grandfather did, and he was a fervent Roman Catholic, he believed that his mother had, in his words, died for the faith. When she came back from South Africa, after her husband had died and converted to Roman Catholicism in around 1900, both her family and her in-laws cut her off, and she lived in intense poverty for about 10 years and subsequently died when my grandfather was just an early teenager. And I think this had an enormous and intense effect on him. I mean, my grandfather was somebody who lost everybody and everything, and I think this isn't something that's so well known about him, and I think it's a very much a key to who he was. His father died of scarlet fever whilst he and his mother and his brother were on holiday in England. Then his mother died of diabetes, and then as an orphan he went into he was living in accommodation in Birmingham, and rather romantically in the room down below, my grandmother, who was at that time about 16 years old, was playing the piano. She played the piano beautifully. And that's how they met. And then they went out walking, and they fell in love. But then Father Francis, who was my grandfather's guardian, said that you may not see Edith again. He completely prohibited him from having any further contact.
Why?
Because he felt that it was unsuitable, both at his age and that he needed to work hard for Oxford. And he probably felt that Edith, perhaps another orphan, and also not Roman Catholic, was an unsuitable match.
How old would he have been at the time?
Perhaps 17. I can't be absolutely certain of that. But with one, it's my understanding that my grandfather obeyed Father Francis entirely and never saw Edith for 4 years until the night of his 21st birthday, which I've always thought is just incredibly romantic. In Exeter College in Oxford, he sat down and wrote to her and said, I've never stopped thinking about you. And then he went on the train to Cheltenham, which is a small town in England, where she was, and where she had become engaged to another man. And he practically forced her, I think, to break it off. And they were married only a few days later.
But she was not Roman Catholic.
She was not Roman Catholic, but he insisted that she convert to Roman Catholicism.
You know, you said a few moments ago you are not a religious person anymore. What does that mean?
It means I'm agnostic. It means that I have, I'm, you know.
What happened?
I became unsure of what happens after we die.
When did you become unsure?
I suppose in my early 20s, late teens, I went to a Roman Catholic school, and I think maybe that was a bit much. I wish that it had been more of how I imagine American school is now, what my daughter's going to. There were monks, and we were lost in the middle of the countryside, and there were no girls, and, you know, that's not quite what I would have wanted. I think my grandfather was quite influential in me going there. I think it was important to him. that I go to a Catholic school, and to my mother as well.
Let's go to another call in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. I'm very proud to be on your program. I was working on a memoir myself, Grandpas Are for All Seasons, when I learned from the British papers that The Lord of the Rings was the book of the century. That was one of the reviews in England. And I said to myself, as an academic, I haven't read the book of the century. So I got a hold of that book right away, and I was reading the introduction, and there's a 2.5-page note in the introduction about the mistakes that were made when that book first came out, and that, in fact, Mr. Tolkien was correcting that book for the rest of his life, and Christopher, one of his sons, was carrying on with those corrections even after he died, you know, in 1973. And so my book was about 550 pages, and it had a lot of mistakes when it first came out. And I said to myself, I'm not a T.R. Tolkien, but I can do what he did. And I called the publisher and told him to take it off the press. And there are about 35 mistakes in this book, and I want them corrected.
Interesting. Is that true, Simon, that there were mistakes in the first publication?
I think there were things that needed to be corrected. I'm not aware that it was like a complete disaster. And I think those were corrected in subsequent editions. What is entirely distinct, and I don't think that my father was involved in correcting, you know, small mistakes. What my grandfather left behind was this vast amount of writing. And I mean, I remember after my grandfather died, my father going through these just endless box files of writing. And those have led to all the books that my father has written. I think there is a side to this which is significant, which is that after my grandfather was unprepared and entirely thrilled by the huge success of The Lord of the Rings. And I think after it was published, he answered many letters, and I think this kind of distracted him from the creative process. I think he was thrilled, and yet it kind of threw him off his trajectory as well. Just as I was saying earlier, that the Lord of the Rings itself, when they asked for more hobbits, threw him off his trajectory earlier. Sometimes that's a good thing, and you know, we got the Lord of the Rings because the Lord of the Rings is so wonderful because there are hobbits, which is the bridge between the reader and these high and mighty events.
All right, let's go to Coral Springs, Florida. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much. Really great listening to you guys. I actually had a question about his relationship with music, because in the Silmarillion, the world is created through song. And I was wondering, you'd mentioned that was, you know, in meeting of your grandmother, but what was music's significance in his life?
I think my grandmother stopped playing the piano, which I think was sad in a way. She could have been perhaps very good at it. I'm not aware that music was intensely important to my grandfather, but I think, as you rightly say, it is significant that in his conception of how the world began, it began through something called the music of the Ainur, which is that the beginning god thought, and out of his thought came the gods, and the gods made music, and out of the music the world was made. And of course, within the music there was discord, and the discord came from the Lucifer figure, which I think is so important, which is Morgoth. And Morgoth's lieutenant afterwards was Sauron. And so you come on to the Sauron of the Lord of the Rings.
When you, as a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old, began reading The Lord of the Rings, could you begin to comprehend it, or did you simply allow your imagination to run free and participate in it? What was your reaction?
I thought it was really thrilling. I didn't know whether they were going to be able to throw the ring into Mount Doom and whether Sauron would triumph and what would happen. The odds seemed unbelievably great that Frodo would be intercepted by a Black Rider or in the early days and would not escape. And the whole cleverness of The Lord of the Rings is that Frodo is able to do what nobody else in the world can do, which is to destroy Sauron by throwing the ring into Orod Ruin, into Mount Doom, because he's invisible. And because also Sauron cannot imagine the idea of somebody wanting to destroy something that would give them power, that is beyond his imagination. The way the Lord of the Rings works internally is a thing of beauty, I think.
And it seemed that way to you as a young child.
Yeah, it's extremely exciting. I mean, it's a journey. You know, I always found the sort of the high and mighty parts a little bit more difficult, but the hobbits and their journey and was quite wonderful.
Simon Tolkien, his new novel is titled The Inheritance. Simon Tolkien is the grandson of J.R.R. Tolkien, and he is a barrister in London specializing in criminal justice. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Delton, Michigan. Good morning, Anne.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a comment. My grandson read The Lord of the Rings when he was about 9, and now he's studying in Derby, England, to become an author. So I think that possibly there is a correlation between wanting to... it gets stuck in you, and you want to become an author after you've read it. And he does want to write fantasy, so I think it's kind of cool.
I think so, too.
Yeah, I think that's cool. It's great.
What do you think of the J.R. Rowling's books?
Well, I love them, especially The Half-Blood Prince, which I loved that. Do you know them, Diane?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've had her on, as a matter of fact.
How fabulous.
Yes.
I love The Pensieve. I thought in The Half-Blood Prince, I thought that was as good as it got, that he was able to actually use the device of The Pensieve for Dumbledore and Harry to go back and see Voldemort's early life. And I've read all of them to my daughter. And we finished about 6 months ago. We went from all the way from volume 1 to the end of volume 7.
And how did you feel about the end of the books?
I thought it ended. I was happy with it. You know, I think she did it beautifully, the way in which Harry grew up during the whole process and had turned into an adult person. It was just fantastic. I loved it.
Simon, I want to go back to your grandfather's relationship with C.S. Lewis and the manner in which they divided. I won't say the friendship ended, but they did go in their separate ways intellectually. To ask of you what you think your grandfather would think about your own writing.
I think he'd be really pleased. I'm not sure that the kind of writing I do would be the kind of writing he wrote, but I think that he put a great premium on creation, and I am creating. I think, you know, and I also feel about my mother, who was a sculptress. I feel that, you know, now she's got Alzheimer's, that it's really great that I'm doing something that is creative as well. And I think he'd have liked that. I think he put a great premium on wanting the reader to turn the page. I mean, as he says in the foreword to The Lord of the Rings, that he wanted to try his hand at, you know, writing something which was a very good read. So I kind of want my readers to turn the page. I think he'd have liked that. And I feel much more comfortable with him now that I've got something of my own than I think I did back before the movies were coming, when I felt dwarfed and also, who am I in the world with these Peter Jackson movies coming my way? We've got The Hobbit coming, of course, now, which is something to be interested about, although I'm a great admirer of the director that they have. And I think the Pan's Labyrinth movie, don't know if you've seen that, Diane. It's just absolutely extraordinary, amazing film. So I'm very interested in what the Hobbit's going to turn out like.
Well, I want to congratulate you on your own achievement and your new novel, The Inheritance. Good luck.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on your show. I really enjoyed it.
Good to meet you.
Thank you.
I'll be off for the next couple of days speaking down in Charlottesville. I'll be back with you on Friday. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.